Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Keep your filthy hands off Trump Tower. That's Donald Trump's latest fundraising pitch to his supporters. Quote, insane radical Democrat AG Letitia James wants to seize my properties in New York. This includes the iconic Trump Tower. So before the day is over, I'm calling on 1 million Trump patriots to chip in and say, stop the witch hunt against President Trump. End quote. The tone of Trump's fundraising emails are always blaringly urgent. But new reporting today suggests that Donald Trump really is panicking about losing his properties. The former president has just 5 days to pay the state of New York a bond of nearly $500 million after he was found liable in the New York Attorney General's civil fraud case against him. Trump has spent the last month desperately trying to find a financial institution, basically an insurer, that would essentially front him the money while he appeals the case. His lawyers claim he's approached more than 30 potential lenders, but so far, none have come through. They say that coming up with a bond of that size is a practical impossibility. Today, the New York Attorney General's office urged an appellate court not to buy those claims, saying that, quote, defendant's argument that obtaining a full bond is purportedly impossible is based on the false premise that they must obtain a single bond from a single surety for the entire judgment amount of $464 million, end quote. And so we wait to see what happens next. Unless the appeals court weighs in and pauses the judgment, if Trump does not find some way to come up with the money before Monday, New York Attorney General Letitia James really can start the process of seizing Trump's assets. And she has made very clear that she's prepared to do just that.
If he does not have funds to pay off the judgment, then we will seek, judgment enforcement mechanisms in court. And we will ask the judge to seize his assets.
We are prepared to make sure that the judgment is paid to New Yorkers. And yes, I look at 40 Wall Street each and every day.
I look at 40 Wall Street each and every day. The attorney general has never once mentioned Trump Tower, Trump's New York City home. Still today, the allies of the former president leaked word to the New York Post that Trump is now considering just letting the New York attorney general seize Trump Tower. Quote, it's an option Trump appears to have considered, partly because he believes the chances are good that he could recover the assets on appeal, even if he's forced to take his case to the U.S. Supreme Court, according to friends, end quote. Now, there are a number of problems with that logic. One, Trump could very easily lose on appeal and therefore lose any chance of getting his property back. Two, even if he did win on appeal, this is interesting, there's no guarantee he would get the seized property back. As one expert told the New York Post, quote, they're going after the money, and that's all he has a right to get back, not the buildings, end quote. Now, Trump does have other options to prevent the state from immediately seizing his assets. He could, for instance, declare bankruptcy. Trump's businesses have, after all, already declared bankruptcy 6 times before. So, hey, what's a 7th bankruptcy at this point? But according to reporting today from CNN, quote, Trump has privately expressed opposition to any path concerning filing for bankruptcy, end quote. As one insider close to Trump told the New York Post, he's been there and done that. Alternatively, he could try to borrow money from some of his wealthy donors, but apparently his ego won't allow for that. He's not an I'm passing the hat man. He doesn't want pity for anyone to feel sorry for him, a source close to Trump told the Post. Now, recipients of Trump's incessant fundraising missives might quibble with the notion that Trump isn't a passing the hat man. But it is in keeping with Trump's public persona for him to be too ashamed to ask for help from someone wealthier than he is. Then there's the possibility that Trump could borrow the money from a foreign power looking to exert influence over Trump, a country like Russia or Saudi Arabia. That theory has mostly been suggested by Trump critics. But watch what happened today when Fox News asked Trump's lawyer if they were considering doing just that.
is there any effort on the part of your team to secure this money through another country, Saudi Arabia or Russia, as Joy Behar seems to think?
Well, there's rules and regulations that are public. I can't speak about strategy that require certain things, and we have to follow those rules.
The question was, are you considering getting money from Saudi Arabia or Russia? The answer there, in case you didn't get that, was, well, there's rules and regulations. I can't speak about strategy. We have to follow those rules. Yeah, of course, because Trump is a big rules guy, as we all know. That response from Trump's lawyer was not exactly the resounding no you might expect if Trump had actually ruled the option of getting money from foreign governments out. So what happens now? For months, we've watched as Donald Trump has managed to obtain delay after delay after delay in his various criminal cases. But in the New York civil case, the clock is running out. The bill is due in 5 days. Joining me now, Adam Pollack, former assistant attorney general in New York, and Adam Klasfeld, who's been covering the court proceedings for Just Security. Thanks to both of you for being here. Let's talk about this. We've sort of tried to lay out the possibilities, but assuming something doesn't happen, Donald Trump has to produce something in 5 days. He's got to produce either a bond or the money.
So he either has to produce a bond, which will stave off enforcement, a bond in the full amount of the judgment, plus interest, expected interest. You're talking about $500+ million bond. That stops enforcement. All enforcement stops while the appeal is pending. And if he loses the appeal, the full amount is paid within 10 days to the state. That's option A. Option B is enforcement can start. Enforcement, the Attorney General's office has said that they'll give a 30-day grace period. They don't have to. In state court, there's no 30-day stay period. There's no window, but they've given till Monday. That means on Monday, they can start seizing financial assets.
Literally, they can go and put a notice on the door of one of his buildings or something?
So there's a sheriff in New York City and a marshal in New York City, sort of like the Wild West, but meets New York City. The Attorney General's office can sign what's called an execution. Nobody dies except for the assets, as it were. Signs an execution, delivers it with a $50 fee to the office of the sheriff or a city marshal, and the marshal can walk into the bank and execute on the assets, drain the bank accounts. And ordinarily, you'd wonder, okay, where does this defendant bank? But here, conveniently, the Attorney General's trial, they did a 2-month trial that was a complete roadmap to his assets.
Right.
They know exactly where he banks.
Adam, are you curious about this? People have speculated this for a while, that at the level of about $500 million, Donald Trump may have trouble raising this money. Now, this is not to say that his value does not exceed this, but it's tied up in assets. We now have a much clearer picture of Donald Trump's cash situation than we have had for all those years of trying to get his tax returns.
Absolutely. And we have a clear picture of his universe and constellation of businesses, from Judge Barbara Jones, who is the court monitor and who is looking over everything. Her recent report said that there are 512 different entities.
Wow.
Now, that is something, as Adam said earlier, it's a roadmap where the public, may not yet, even people who have been following this very closely, have a clear idea of what this maze and thicket of companies are. But the AG knows that.
Right.
The monitor knows that. And pretty soon, that might be coming to a head in the enforcement phase.
Adam, let's talk about the fairness of the system, right? If you are found responsible and you have to pay money, there is an appeals process. And if you put someone else into the situation who's not Donald Trump, it may be onerous for people to come up with money, which is why we have the surety system. Tell me how that works. Why does he, what does the surety mean? What does the bond mean versus him actually having the money?
So the bond is written by an insurance broker on behalf of an insurance company. And unlike your car insurance or your homeowner's insurance, most cars don't crash, right? And so you might pay $2,000 a year to insure a $30,000 car. But most people lose their appeal, right? You already lost in the court below. So this insurer is taking a significant risk, right? They are insuring that the full amount of the judgment from the court below will be paid if the Attorney General, in this case, the plaintiff, wins her appeal if Trump loses the appeal. So the bond pays out. It's an insurance policy, effectively, that pays out the full amount. Okay.
Adam, he's got assets. But this is never, for anybody who has any assets at all, anybody who's got a car or a house, nobody wants to have to liquidate it in fire sale terms. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in this particular instance, if he loses an asset, if he has to give up, or if the sheriff and the marshal come and put a claim on a property beyond his bank accounts, you don't always get the best value for that. So that can't be Trump's preferred option.
Oh, it can't be. And one of the interesting things in the interview that Tish James gave, she mentioned one property in particular, and that's 40 Wall
Right.
Street. And it kind of harkens back to this moment of the trial. I remember when Trump was giving his testimony in his discursive and meandering style, and he said that Tish James doesn't even know where 40 Wall Street is, and she laughed out loud because she could see it from her office.
Right.
And other people from the AG's office were laughing, too. One wonders if that's what she has her sights on. And Trump did say his entire pitch to the appellate court in trying to halt this process is that the real estate isn't liquid and that the bonding companies won't work with him as a result of that. Now, the AG says that's not true, that maybe his properties aren't as valuable as he says they are.
Right. There's something. They could probably add up a bunch of properties and come up to the amount of money he needs. I guess the issue is, you both have mentioned this roadmap. We know where Donald Trump's finances are, at least the attorney general does. What is this business of him potentially declaring bankruptcy or companies declaring bankruptcy? What's his personal culpability versus these 500 entities that Donald Trump has?
So if you look at the judgment lays out which entity has culpability, has liability for the judgment, is a judgment debtor, no longer a defendant, but has moved on to being a judgment debtor, owes the money. And one owns $125 million and another $200 million. It's a lot of money. He could declare bankruptcy, an entity could declare bankruptcy, but bankruptcy doesn't wipe the debt clean. Bankruptcy pauses and brings in a bankruptcy judge and a bankruptcy trustee to sort out where are the assets and where are the liabilities, and he'd still have to pay. Assuming that his assets still exceed the liabilities, he'd still be on the hook and the entities would still be on the hook.
Adam, this idea of raising money from a foreign source, particularly a foreign government, it's speculation. There's no sense that that's true, which surprised me about that Fox interview, because you would think the answer to that would be a resounding no. Of course, we're not trying to raise money from the Russians or the Saudis. I don't know if either of you understand that answer about why I said, well, there's rules and things like that. But it made me think maybe you are talking to a foreign entity about paying these bills.
It's a classic non-denial denial.
Right.
She didn't say we are putting this off the table, just as you mentioned, but she didn't say we're going to do this. It's a way to kind of dodge the question in a textbook style that every journalist and reporter looks out for.
Adam, one thing I haven't understood since the beginning of this is we know that Donald Trump raises money every time he feels under threat in some fashion. Would that be sufficient? Would that be legal? If he did this campaign and said, save Trump Tower, every Trump supporter, give a dollar before midnight, and he raises the money?
Look, it's not easy to raise $500 million.
Right. Even for Donald Trump.
Even for Donald Trump.
Right.
B, I don't think that you can use campaign money to pay for an appellate bond on your personal liability. There are campaign finance laws, and they prohibit that sort of thing.
Guys, I've learned a lot. Thank you both for being here, both Adams, Adam Klossfeld and Adam Pollack. Adam Pollack is the former assistant attorney general in New York. Adam Klossfeld works for Just Security. All right, we got a lot more to get to tonight, including newly released facts that undercut Fox News's fear-mongering about crime in America. We'll explain. Plus, the Biden administration today gave a new jolt to the electric vehicle industry and to fight the fight against climate change. We'll have more on that just ahead.
Hey, everybody.
everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
There were many bizarre things about Donald Trump's presidency, but one that was notably consistent and equally confusing was his odd obsession with appliances.
Sinks, toilets, light bulbs. But sinks, toilets, and showers, you don't get any water.
People are flushing toilets 10 times, 15 times. As opposed to once.
Sinks, right? Showers. And what goes with a sink and a shower? 10 times, right? 10 times. Bob, not me, of course, not me.
I feel if you need to flush the toilet 10 times, you should speak to your doctor. But Trump was very fixated on the energy efficiency efforts of past administrations. He even made it a point to roll back more than 100 environmental rules while he was in office. And now that he's campaigning for a second shot at office, he's got a new obsession, one that's got less to do with the bathroom and more to do with the driveway.
We are a nation whose leaders are demanding all electric cars, despite the fact that they don't go far, cost too much, and whose batteries are produced in China with materials only available in China.
On day one, I will terminate Crooked Joe's ridiculous electric vehicle mandate. It's so ridiculous.
Kind of amazing that he still says China like that. Trump says that electric cars will kill the U.S. auto industry and the economy, which is not true. In fact, the car industry has been crystal clear that electric vehicles are the future. It's the logical economic path and a crucial transition to make it if we plan to confront climate change, a crisis that is primarily fueled by oil and gas emissions. And this very reason is why the latest regulatory move by the current president, President Biden, is in fact a huge deal. Today, the Biden administration announced a new rule on tailpipe emissions, which may not sound monumental on its face, but experts are hailing it as the single most important climate regulation in the history of the country. Let's talk about this. Joining me is the renowned climate activist and author Bill McKibben. Bill, thank you for being with us. I want to get your take on this because a lot of people who are serious about climate say we have to change the way we move around. We have to think about movement differently than our car-obsessed society does. But while we remain a car-obsessed society, this seems to me like a step in the right direction.
Well, for sure. Put it in context. You know, today, the World Meteorological Organization reminded us that 2023 was the hottest year in the last 125,000. They issued what they called a red alert for climate change. So far, 2024 is hotter than 2023. We've got to do something. And that means we've got to do something about what in America is one of the biggest sources of emissions, transportation, cars and trucks. This rule that Biden put forward today is not that strong. It actually relaxes somewhat the trajectory that they were on because the UAW, the Auto Workers Union, and others have said maybe we're moving a little too fast, but it does continue the momentum towards the electrification of our automobile fleet. And if you think about, Ali, the things that we have to do to deal with climate change, this is not a very hard one. What we're asking people to do is over the next decade, change in their current car for one that's probably already cheaper or headed that way, that's quieter, that has fewer moving parts, that costs a lot less to operate, that's not a particularly large sacrifice to demand. The main sacrifice, of course, comes from the fossil fuel industry, who wants to keep selling you gas forever.
Right.
And so today they announced they were launching a seven-figure ad campaign in the swing states, accusing Biden of a electric vehicle mandate, which this, for better or for worse, is not. Trump, you may recall, last weekend promised a bloodbath in America.
Yep.
And the thing that he was talking about when he talked about the bloodbath was electric vehicles. So like it or not, climate change and the things we have to do to begin to deal with it is now front and center in this campaign.
Yeah. And I think you make an interesting point, because there are people, including yourself, who think that if we want to take this as seriously as we should, it requires massive behavioral change, not just behavioral change, but infrastructure change, right? So that we can use public transit more than our own cars. But that said, this shift, this emphasis on electric vehicles will be almost indiscernible to people who make the shift. Right. All that happens is you charge your car as opposed to you go to the gas station, which makes me wonder why Donald Trump gets so invested in the fact that this is some kind of an evil takeover by bad people. It just doesn't make that much of a difference to most people.
A, as usual, the guy has no idea what he's talking about. He said the other day that electric vehicles only go 15 miles. I've been driving an EV for years, and it goes 250. The ones that they're building now go 400 or 500. So part of it's that, but mostly it's the fact that the Republican Party on these issues for years now has been a wholly owned subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry. And the biggest threat to them is that people will stop having to fill up all the time. Look, I hardly even remember how to operate the gas pump anymore, because I just plug into the wall at home. And, you know, the price of running that car is much smaller than it was before. It's good for me. It's bad for Exxon. And that should give you some clue as to why the fossil fuel industry has launched this seven-figure ad campaign.
Bill, does this give you confidence? And I ask you this as a proxy for people who don't think that Donald Trump's going to be the answer to fighting climate change, but who are a little bit dissatisfied with the pace at which the Biden administration has gone on this, despite some major milestones that they have achieved. Does this feel like movement in the right direction, meaningfully or not really?
No one's ever moving fast enough, but in this case, the choice could not be clearer. I mean, Third Act, this organization for people over 60, endorsed Biden this week. And one of the biggest reasons was because it's abundantly clear that if we elect Donald Trump, it will be a full-on pound-the-brake halt to the momentum that's developed around renewable energy. It's not that Biden's doing everything right. He's not, because he's in a politically constrained environment. But he is reorienting our society in the right direction, beginning to spend the money that we need, and given four more years, would probably make some serious progress. The contrast between that and the guy who, remember, pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accords last time. Mm-hmm. The guy who told us that global warming was a hoax invented by the Chinese. I mean, come on. How many floods and fires and droughts do you have to see before you understand that really it's time to start moving?
Bill, thanks again for being with us and for all that you have done over the last several decades to keep this issue front and center. Bill McKibben is an author and environmentalist. All right, more ahead this evening, including Alabama weighing into the culture wars, enacting a ban on the teaching of diversity, equity and inclusion. A Democratic state lawmaker joins me with her reaction later this hour. But first, Donald Trump and right wing media's focus on depicting the country as a crime infested hellscape. A new FBI report on crime reveals that narrative to be more fiction than fact. We'll have more on that next.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The crime issue is really serious.
It's never been more clear in America that we are in a crime crisis.
We've been documenting the retail theft across America now for 3 years. It's rampant.
The problem that's driving these retailers out of these states and cities is crime, which is rampant.
It's the crime, stupid. It's the crime, stupid. It's the crime, stupid.
Now, if you were to randomly flip on Fox News, there are pretty decent odds you'd find yourself watching a segment about how Biden's America is rampant with crime. America is in a crime crisis. And it's not just Fox. Trump is also obsessed with crime, but a very specific kind of crime.
It's a new category. I don't know if you've heard this, but I came up with this one, migrant crime. There's crime, there's violent crime, there's migrant crime. We have a new category of crime. It's called migrant crime.
The United States is being overrun by the Biden migrant crime. It's a new form of vicious violation to our country. It's migrant crime. We call it Biden migrant crime.
Hey, there's a problem with that. Because what Trump and Fox are pushing lack facts. Across the country, the crime rate is down and it's continuing to drop. We got new FBI crime data yesterday that shows that no matter how you slice it, America is getting safer. Property crime is down. Violent crime is down. The murder rate saw the sharpest annual decline ever recorded. And that supposed wave of migrant crime that Trump is obsessed with, Fox News ran 400 segments on it in the first 10 weeks of this year. But the facts are not on Trump or Fox's side on that either. Statistically speaking, immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than U.S.-born citizens are. But you don't hear that on Fox News. Now, none of this is to say that many communities across the country aren't still grappling with very real incidents of crime or that we should turn away from efforts to reduce crime. But the narrative being pushed here that crime is on a precipitous rise under Biden's Democratic administration is simply false. What facts, Fox News lacks in facts, it makes up for, though, in vibes.
The Democrats will say, well, but crime is down. It's not how people feel.
We all know communities don't feel safer.
And you do see crime on the rise. And, I know President Biden held that whole press on how crime is down in America. I don't know. Again, it's do you believe your lying eyes or do you believe the president of the United States?
He just at the White House a few moments ago was touting a drop in crime statistics. That is not what we're all feeling and seeing.
Don't believe your lying eyes. The reality is that crime in America started spiking in 2020 during the pandemic when Donald Trump was president. But Fox News is taking advantage of a gap between perception and reality here. Polling shows us that almost every year for the past few decades, Americans have felt like the country was getting more dangerous, even when it wasn't. And those feelings now have a partisan split to them. Last year, Gallup found that 92% of Republicans believe crime rose from the year before, compared to 58% of Democrats. Wonder why. All right, still ahead tonight, an education bill that hundreds of students protested earlier this month just became law in Alabama, making it the latest state to target diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'll talk to Alabama State Representative Wandalyn Givan about that next.
Nearly 300 students gathered in Montgomery today to protest the SB 129 DEI bill.
This ultimately bleeds into every way of life as an Alabama resident, not just limited towards public organizations. History shall not and will not repeat. The time has come for a new wave of activists and empowered individuals to speak up and spread justice and equity in every way possible.
That was Samford University student Akeem Timms, gathered with hundreds of Alabama student protesters earlier this month. And the bill he referenced was a new Alabama Senate bill restricting diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in the state's public schools, universities, and colleges. And the history Akeem Timms referenced included this. Spring 1963, thousands of students gathered to protest segregation in Alabama. They faced fire hoses, police dogs, and arrests while calling for the diversification of classrooms in one of the most segregated cities in the country. That was just 61 years ago. And today, it became that much harder to learn that history and to diversify classrooms in Alabama. Despite student protests today, Governor Kay Ivey signed that new anti-DEI bill into law. The bill, which takes effect on October 1st, prohibits the teaching of, quote, divisive concepts, including that individuals are inherently responsible for actions committed in the past, or that meritocracy is racist or sexist. It also bans schools and agencies from sponsoring DEI programs, and it bans trans people from using restrooms that align with their gender identity. Criticizing the bill, Birmingham Mayor Woodfin wrote, if supporting inclusion becomes illegal in this state, hell, you might as well stand in front of the school door like Governor Wallace. Governor Wallace, the former Alabama governor who, in 1963, stood in a doorway to block black students from attending classes at the University of Alabama. He's the one whose inaugural promise was, quote, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Joining me now is the Alabama State Representative, Gwendolyn Givan. Representative, good to see you. Thank you for being with us this evening. I'd like to get your reaction to this. It's a pretty sweeping bill that doesn't really address anything that most people who understand DEI believe is DEI. It just seems to be a generally anti-diversification and diversity education bill.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for having me tonight. I'm very disheartened by this bill. You referenced 1963. I represent in my legislative district the area in which four little girls were killed at the 16th Street Baptist Church that were bombed attending Sunday school. I fought against this legislation, SB 129. And on the House floor, let me just simply say to you what I said. I simply echoed these words. This bill takes me back. This is a rollback of Brown v. Wade versus the Board of Education. This takes me to Plessy v. Ferguson. This takes me to a time in history that just a few weeks ago, here in the state of Alabama, we celebrated the 59th anniversary of the bombing of the 16th Street, crossing of the Edmund Pettus Bridge. I'm so alarmed by this piece of legislation and to term it divisive concepts. Well, affirmative action was put in place in this country for a reason. It gave individuals who have been marginalized in this country an opportunity, a fair shot, whether they lived in a certain social economic or had a social economic status versus that of our counterparts or not. To me, this is racism 101. This is beyond Jim Crow on steroids. And I'm very concerned by what message this sends throughout this country, throughout the world, that we're doing here in Alabama, in a state so rich for discriminatory practices.
One that we've been concentrating a lot on lately because of the restrictions on reproductive practices. It seems like there are a lot of conservative thinkers and think tanks who are behind this movement to ban DEI. In many cases, the same people who think there's been censorship at university campuses and there's not enough free thought. And yet this concept about learning about things like 1961 and 1963 and black history in America and wondering and being curious about what reparations or fixing it looks like is actually being shut down by people who complain that their speech has been shut down on other fronts.
Absolutely. We live in a time here in the state of Alabama where it's no longer good or safe to be black in America. Well, I'm a black woman. I'm proud to be a black woman. I'm proud of my heritage. We have individuals that are carrying pieces of legislation such as this one, just as they did with the CRT bill. But when you ask them the question, do you know what 1619 meant in this country? They can't tell you that 1619 is when the first slave trade took place, when black slaves were taken to Jamestown when you're asked the question, do you know what the Middle Passage was? But yet you're bringing bills that will tell me or tell any other individual that my blackness does not exist, or if I have an LGBTQ brother or sister, that their rights no longer exist. But if you would allow me just to take it a step further, what we're witnessing now is the realization of what may happen in November. Mm-hmm. This is Trumpism at its best. This will be a continuation of rollbacks. We saw that in the Dodd case, in which a woman's right to choose was rolled back. We're now seeing it here with what is considered or dubbed as divisive concept laws that are now spreading or that will spread across the union. LGBTQ rights will become further under attack. So my question is, what rights will people such as myself and marginalized people in mm-hmm. this country have in? I'm sitting here now thinking about the Dred Scott decision. I shouldn't have to be thinking about that. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, crossing that Edmund mm-hmm. Pettus to head to Montgomery to fight for just a simple right to vote when every day those rights are being stripped away. But I'm also concerned for my Democratic brothers and sisters who do not understand the importance uh-huh. of what November election will mean to us and people who look like me in this country. That is what SB 129, the effect that SB 129 will have. It's a rollback. And as I mentioned, beyond Jim Crow on steroids, this thing is taking me back to an era where I can still hear my grandparents talk about what it was like to hear that bomb that went off at the 16th Street Baptist Church. But what it also says to me is that my black in America is not beautiful, that I'm not given those inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in this country.
Thank you for connecting this, what a lot of people might think is an abstraction, to something very real and what people can do about it in November. This is not something to watch and say, hey, it's Alabama. They do some crazy stuff down there. This is the kind of thing that is catching on in other parts of the country as well. Wandalyn Gavan, thank you for joining us tonight. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
All right, we have one more story coming up as Benjamin Netanyahu signals that he's determined to launch a ground offensive in Gaza's densely packed southernmost city. A look at the leverage that President Biden has to prioritize the protection of civilians. That's next.
I can guarantee you this. The days when the Jewish people remain passive in the face of genocidal enemies, those days are over. We are no longer scattered among the nations, powerless to defend ourselves. We've restored our sovereignty in our ancient home, and the soldiers who defend our home have boundless courage. For the first time in 100 generations, we, the Jewish people, can defend ourselves.
That was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in 2015 making a joint address to Congress urging against a nuclear deal with Iran. He raised the specter of genocide in his remarks, but said defiantly that Israel could defend itself. However, that was not entirely true then, and it's not entirely true today. Israel has never defended itself by itself. Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid since its creation. According to congressional data, it has received more than $200 billion in economic assistance and billions more in missile defense funding. That assistance includes some of the weapons that Israel is using in its war with Hamas, a war that has now claimed more than 31,000 lives and counting, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. At the start of this conflict, President Joe Biden was quick to offer his unwavering support of Israel's right to defend itself, but he's begun criticizing Prime Minister Netanyahu over attacks on civilians and a blockade of aid that could force as many as 1.1 million people, half the population of Gaza, to the brink of starvation. President Biden keeps calling for Israel to show restraint, but could he go farther? He has leverage in this situation. The supply of U.S. weapons paid for by American citizens that Israel is using in this war. So why won't the president use that particular leverage? Joining me now is Michelle Goldberg, opinion columnist for The New York Times. Michelle, thank you for being with us. It's an interesting few weeks we've been watching where President Biden announced airdrops of aid, announced a sea bridge that Antony Blinken says will be in effect in about 2 weeks. as if we're dealing with a country with whom we don't enjoy great influence. He would really like Netanyahu to allow the aid into Gaza, and yet he can't get him to do it.
Well, look, I think that, you know, Netanyahu has always shown, you know, he expects enormous amounts of deference from American leaders and shows Democratic presidents, you know, kind of complete contempt and defiance. And we've seen this over and over again. And I think he depends on domestic politics constraining American presidents, or at least Democratic American presidents, because obviously Israel has very strong supporters among, you know, large parts of the American Jewish community, among evangelical Christians. It's made it in the past, you know, kind of politically poisonous to go against Israel. But that hasn't always been the case. You know, I think an example that people bring up all the time is Ronald Reagan basically demanding that Begin stop, I think, what he called a Holocaust in Lebanon in the 80s. And there's other times in which American presidents have exercised real leverage over Israel. It just falls to Biden to actually do it.
But what you just commented on, what Netanyahu knows, is that there are domestic political considerations about that in America. So where Biden is facing pressure from some progressives and some people within the Democratic Party for not exercising that leverage that he's got, if he were to, what happens then?
Well, I think that, look, there's blowback either way. And so at a certain point, you say, you know, you have to kind of make a decision based on morality and leadership, not just domestic political calculations. Not that domestic political calculations are unimportant, especially given the existential threat that's at stake in the November election. But I think that, look, I mean, you have Chuck Schumer basically talking about Netanyahu as an obstacle to peace. You have a huge amount of opposition to this Israeli government among Jews, the vast majority of whom are Democrats. And so either way, because this is an issue that divides the Democratic Party, either way, there's going to be some fallout. But I think the fallout, I mean, besides, there is the fallout from not acting is humanitarian catastrophe. I mean, the only thing that I would disagree with you, Ali, is when you said, I think that over a million people might be on the brink of starvation. They're on the brink of starvation now. You know, by the time they actually, as I'm sure you know, it's by the time they actually declare a famine,
right,
it is going to
you're well
too
into
late
it. Yep.
To save so many of these people. And so, and then I also think just in terms of kind of our national security, the idea of kind of showing strength can sometimes be overrated in American politics, but there's something kind of pathetic about having Israel that is so dependent, or at least so willing, you know, such a massive recipient of American aid, being so defiant of the wishes and the demands of the American government.
You make an interesting point. The Chuck Schumer stuff, the speech he made last week, may have been lost on some people. It's remarkable, Chuck Schumer going out on that much of a limb to criticize Benjamin Netanyahu. And look, he's America's highest ranking elected Jewish person. He was not critical of Israel, the country. He was simply critical of Netanyahu and stopped just a little short of asking him to resign. But he did think Israel should elect a new leader.
Right. And my guess is that Chuck Schumer does not go out and give a speech like that without giving a heads up to the White House. I think that at this point, you know, Netanyahu he's obviously an obstacle, or his government is an obstacle to getting humanitarian aid into Gaza. And also he's an obstacle to any sort of plan for the day after, which is one reason why they are, you know, there's a lot of reasons why they are quickly losing support in the United States and around the world. But one is because there's no end to this on the horizon. There's no day after.
Michelle, thank you as always. It's good to see you, my friend. Michelle Goldberg is an opinion columnist for The New York Times. And that is our show for tonight.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.